The NFL playoffs are better with FanDuel because right now new customers can bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, guaranteed. That's $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. FanDuel, an official sportsbook partner of the NFL. 21 plus and present in select states. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets which expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
At Verizon, anyone can trade in their old phone for a new one on us with Unlimited Ultimate, which means everyone in your family could get a new phone and stay on your family plan, keeping you close.
Hey, Mom, you seen my toothbrush?
Yeah, I'm almost done with it.
Oh, maybe too close. Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
That's one of our most commonly asked questions, best peptide stack for muscle gain. And it's pretty misleading because a lot of peptide stacks are actually for recovery, but it depends on your labs. So if your growth hormone and IGF-1 are very low, then you're gonna respond much better to growth hormone releasing peptides, and you're probably a better candidate for them anyway. Often the risks outweigh the benefits for people who are very young, who usually have very high growth hormone levels. So if your IGF-1 is less than about 120, then probably a growth hormone-releasing peptide like tesamorelin or somorelin or hexarelin is going to be the best choice for muscle gain with the least amount of downsides. That being said, a lot of people consider SARMs peptides, and those aren't quite ready to be used as medications. And a lot of people think that the Wolverine stack that has things like BPC-157 and TB-500 are good for muscle gain, and they're really not. It's a great question. So things like the Wolverine stack are great for recovery. BPC-157 has a lot of the same benefits as PRP, but systemically, increasing VEGF, with the downside of potential tumor growth risk. And things like TB-500 or GHK copper peptide, a lot of these others can be taken subcutaneously as well, and they can be very helpful for recovery. That being said, even things like hormone replacement or over-the-counter supplementation with taurine or beta-alanine or even bicarb can improve recovery from aerobic exercise. GHRPs can also improve recovery, but if your growth hormone and IGF-1 levels are normal or high normal to start, it's probably just not worth the risks like high blood glucose or tumor growth in order to push these things higher to have slightly better recovery. What is the appropriate age to start TRT? 50 years old. Just kidding. There's no such thing as an appropriate age to start TRT or appropriate age to start HCG. Some people would like to think that at age 20 you can start clomiphene or enclomiphene, and then at 35 you can start HCG, which is actually about the same time I started HCG, coincidentally. And then 50 is when you can start true TRT. But if you want to do TRT plus, you can cycle it on and off, but only between 40 and 50. And this is ridiculous. You should talk with your physician or your healthcare provider about all the risks and all the benefits of all of these various interventions. They're just tools to help your lifestyle be better, and then make an informed decision. Ideally, the benefits far outweigh the risks, regardless of what age you are. And if you say, well, my doctor has no idea about what TRT is, then get another doctor. They're very affordable. I think you can see Dr. Martin or Dr. Egan for less than you're probably spending on peptides and SARMs on whatever website that or cookie cutter clinic that you're getting them on. Because at the end of the day, if you're going to a lawyer for a patent issue, then you don't go to a family law lawyer. You go to a patent lawyer. And the same thing when you're seeking out to improve your health span and going for preventive medicine, you don't go to your average doctor. You go to someone like Dr. Taylor Martin, board certified in preventive medicine and well-versed in health and hormone optimization. What do I wish I knew before starting HCG? Quite a bit. One, I wish I'd started earlier. Just because of varicoceles and atrophy that I could have staved off earlier in the process. I didn't start it until after I had a couple kids. So probably could have had a lot better energy during residency and after residency, and less atrophic changes and just straight up pain from the heat damage and the swelling. But what I really wish that I knew is how much is it going to affect my skin? A lot of people, no issues with HCG, but I just tend to get quite a bit of acne whenever I take it, regardless of the rest of my regimen. And I also tended to get quite a bit of skin breakouts when I was an adolescent as well. So perhaps this is correlated, and I do see when patients take it, if they've had breakouts in the past, it does tend to happen more with HCG. But it also can lead to swelling and pain of the gonads. So that's quite common. So you want to make sure you're not on too high of a dose. If you're on too low of a dose, it can also still decrease your LH and not give you as much benefit. So dose is super important for HCG, and that can be quite an individual by individual basis. In general, if you're not on HRT otherwise, so if you're on monotherapy, just HCG, then you want to look at something more like 500 IU 3 times a week. Whereas if it's an adjunct to TRT, it can be less than that. Before you start a GLP-1, you need to do these things. Number one is see how much you need it, which means get a full lab panel, look at your fasting insulin, look at your A1C, your fructosamine if your A1C is not accurate, your fasting glucose, maybe a CGM, and see what your risk factors are. Does everyone in your family have a gallbladder attack and have to get their gallbladder taken out at around your age? Then you're probably high risk. Have you had a couple kids? Has your estrogen been high? Have you been estrogen dominant? Higher risk. Do you have nausea and vomiting from time to time? Do you have constipation issues before starting? And those things are likely going to occur. Have you had a postoperative ileus or bowel surgery? All these things you need to talk about with your physician. But what you have to do that you might not be thinking of, and maybe your physician isn't thinking of, get a DEXA scan for body composition, not just bone density, but see how much muscle mass you have and fat mass you have. This is what you want to track, and your end goal, other than just having great labs, should be being under about 33% body fat as a female and about 22% body fat as a male on a DEXA scan. That correlates with probably 27% and maybe 15% on something like an InBody for a male or a female who's exercising very frequently. So your endpoint should not be a weight number. That doesn't really tell us a lot. It should be a body fat percentage number on a DEXA scan. Before you inject a subcutaneous injection or a shallow intramuscular injection, it's important to understand dead space in your needle because it can change the actual dose that gets in your body. So insulin syringes are the first syringes that are considered low dead space. This is an insulin syringe. And this is one of my favorite ones for subcutaneous injections. You can also use them for dermal injections. And this is a 31-gauge syringe. It has a tiny needle. It's only 5/16 inch long. But you can tell when you inject it, it has almost no dead space left. So if you compare that to a tuberculin or a lure lock or a lure slip syringe, this is a Magellan syringe, and it is a safety syringe, which is kind of nice. But when you take the top off, you can see that even if you finish injecting, there is more dead space. So basically, medication gets trapped in this little area between here and the tip of the syringe. The same thing happens if you have a true lure lock syringe. For example, if you have a 1cc syringe right here, and then you put a needle on the tip of it, there's going to be medication left in that little area on the bottom of the needle, or the lure lock area, if you will. So if you're gonna switch between these two forms, for example, let's say you're tired of waiting to have your medication drop in this syringe, then you'll likely need to, of course, talk to your doctor and potentially increase the dose that you're putting into the syringe because the same amount will get into your body. These are two common setups for subcutaneous injections. This is a 31-gauge insulin syringe. It's from Easy Touch. In a lot of states, you can actually get these on Amazon without a prescription. But there's very low dead space, so you inject almost all the medication that gets in the syringe. However, it can take a long time to drop things in these insulin syringes, especially if they're in oil, for example, a hormone. They're in carrier oils. This is a lure lock tuberculin syringe or a lure lock syringe. You can tell it's 1cc. It's a lock because you twist it on. You can see the little twists. And it draws up much faster. So if you take this off, you can put a pretty big needle. This is a 21-gauge needle, which is pretty thick. And then, of course, you can alcohol wipe it off. This spot on the skin and on the bottle. And then you wait for it to dry. You can wave it to help it dry faster. But when you put the needle in here, you can inject air first if you happen to have air in. That's something that can help with the pressure in. And then you draw it up, you draw it up, you draw it up. And then you take your needle out. With lure lock syringes like this, right now in this dead space, basically in the bubble that's in the needle right now, you need to draw that back into your syringe. Otherwise, you're going to waste it before you twist this off and switch your syringe to the smaller syringe. And then once you switch it to the smaller syringe, you can push it back up. And that way you don't lose any medication other than in this smaller syringe. Otherwise, you'll lose the medication in the big needle and the small needle. This is a fake arm. It was actually used for Nexplanon training. Not that that matters. But this is an insulin syringe. And let's say I have pretend medication in here. You have 15 cc's of medication. As you inject in the skin, you know, there's not, as long as you clean it off, there's not really a wrong way to do it. You inject and then you wait there for a second and then you draw back out. If it's skin that needs to be taut, then you can pull up with your finger as you inject like this and then inject. If it's skin and you're super lean, and let's say you're trying to do a subcutaneous injection, you can actually bunch the skin up like this. Let's say this is on your hip, which is called ventral glute, or even on your abdomen if you're super thin. That way you're more superficial and you inject more in the fat and you're not hitting your muscle. Then you inject and then you pull back out. If you use a different syringe, like obviously this is not ideal, but if you use a longer needle, you do not have to bury your needle all the way. So this is still a 27 gauge needle. So it's still pretty tiny, but it's a very long needle. So if you hold it closer to the tip, you have better control of the needle than if you hold it way back here. So you can hold it right at the tip. And then again, you can bunch up your skin and then and with clean skin, you can inject just a little bit, bunch it up so it's subcutaneous, and then gently pull out. And you'll have a lot less post-injection pain. The downside to more superficial injections is you get more lumping. So basically, especially if it's an oil like testosterone or estradiol or progesterone, it'll get caught closer to the skin. There's a couple ways to dispose of your needle after an injection. It actually matters state by state. So in some states, you can take an old laundry detergent container or hard plastic and then duct tape or other strong tape around the seal so it's sealed up and just put it in the trash. Of course, you can use a sharps container in pretty much any state. Some require a prescription to get, some do not. And then if it's a small enough syringe, you know, a bigger needle like this might be kind of hard to clip even if it fits in a needle clipper like this. I can't really find these anymore. Hopefully BD continues to make them. I can't tell why they took them off places like Amazon, but you used to be able to buy these for $5. A syringe like this, yes, you have a little bit of medication left in that bubble there, but it would take a couple chomps. So this, I think, is best to just put in a sharps container, even though it technically fits. With this, you can very carefully put the open needle into that hole right there, and then after you get it in the hole, you want to go nice and close, otherwise it's obviously still sharp. Clip it, and then there's basically no tip left. So, however, I still wouldn't recommend touching it, but it's much less likely to cause a, it's not going to cause a needle poke that actually breaks the skin. If you cut half the needle off, then it can still break the skin. But when I do that, I just recap the blunt tip, there's no needle anymore, and then throw these away. So there's a couple ways to dispose of needles, but check to see what is best in your state or check with your physician before deciding. Quick tip for drawing up medication. The size of the syringe matters. So if you ever injected lidocaine or something like that, if you're injecting with a 10 cc, which is a 10 milliliter syringe, or 5 cc, it's significantly harder than if it's with a 1 cc. The same principle applies for drawing up thick viscosity oils. This is just saline or water, but if this were something that was in an oil, whether it's grapeseed oil or cottonseed oil, then it'd be much easier to draw up with this 1 cc syringe than with this 3 cc or certainly a 5 cc syringe. So if you are administering medication with a 3 cc syringe, which I see a lot of people do, or 5 cc, ask your physician or healthcare provider if you'd be better off switching to a 1 cc syringe. Many people ask if alcohol wipes are necessary, and I suppose there are other ways to clean the skin or to clean the rubber stopper, like hypochlorous solution, but it is reasonable to use the alcohol wipe to clean the top of your medication and then let it dry. And while it's drying, I flip it over and then clean the area of the skin that's going to be injected as well and also let that dry. while those are drying, then you can think about things like prepping your needle. Are you going to use an insulin syringe? Are you going to use a tuberculin syringe? But there's really no reason why not to use an alcohol wipe, even if the risk of infection is low. This is one of the types of hypochlorous acid solutions. I just call it hypochlorous solution. And this is an alcohol wipe. This is technically a sterile solution. It can be used instead of betadine. It can be used instead of chlorhexidine, which is Hibiclens. And we do use this a lot in the clinic. And you can also irrigate wounds with it directly, which is nice. So surgeons like this solution. But it's not really necessary for doing things like cleaning the rubber stopper of a medication vial or cleaning skin. For those purposes, an alcohol wipe can be used. This is a 25-gauge needle on a lure lock syringe. This is one of the most commonly used combinations for injection of testosterone in oil or estradiol in oil. And it's not a bad combination. It's certainly better than even larger needles that are occasionally used. But as you can see, it is not a tiny needle, especially when you compare it to this specific 27-gauge syringe. These are actually my favorite that I like most patients to use, as long as they are patient enough to wait while drawing up the medication. So if you're drawing up a lot of the carrier oil, that's going to take a lot longer in this 27-gauge, half-inch, 0.5cc insulin syringe when you compare it to drawing up with a 25-gauge. Another benefit of this 25-gauge is you can twist it off and inject it with a smaller needle, like a 27-gauge or even a 30-gauge if you wait long enough when you're injecting it. But you do lose some medication in the injecting needle's bubble in the lure lock area, whereas this, you lose almost nothing. So I do prefer these 27-gauges, but if you need something faster, I'm not against a 25 or even a 22 to draw up and then inject with something like a 27. Speak with your physician about the risks and benefits of these. These are also nice because you can protect the needle by pushing this up to make it no longer as sharp. But the benefit of these is that you can clip them in a needle clipper like this one. So talk to your doctor about the benefits of both, but easy rule of thumb, if you're patient enough during the drop of the medication, I do prefer these easy touch 27-gauge insulin syringes.
The NFL playoffs are better with FanDuel because right now new customers can bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets. Guaranteed. That's $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. FanDuel, an official sportsbook partner of the NFL. 21 plus and present in select states. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets which expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
At Verizon, anyone can trade in their old phone for a new one on us with Unlimited Ultimate, which means everyone in your family could get a new phone and stay on your family plan, keeping you close.
Hey, Mom, you seen my toothbrush?
Yeah, I'm almost done with it.
Oh, maybe too close.
Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.